From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Kyle Crawford.
And I'm Kate Aronoff.
This week on War News Radio, Movement in War. We talk to Iraqis commuting in Baghdad and examine how the conflict has turned the city's streets into a transportation nightmare.
I don't see more signals. And if they exist, they don't work, or it is necessary to follow police officers to organize the cars. Since there is no electricity in Iraqi streets, the signals don't work. Except in some streets, there are signals working all the time, because it's an important street.
Improvised explosive devices have been the biggest cause of U.S. casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan for the last 3 years. We talked to military experts about how the bombs are made and how they're fighting them.
It's still the number one problem on the battlefield is still the IED. And how I relate that to people is the IED has become a condition of our workplace or our environment in theater.
Finally, we talked to some Iraqis about the ups and downs of living with neighbors who keep a very high profile.
Of course, you feel more secure. You feel VIP yourself.
You feel more secure. You feel like a VIP yourself. You feel more privileged than anyone in another neighborhood.
This is War News Radio. A lot has changed in Baghdad since coalition forces arrived in April 2003. Roads have been blocked off and checkpoints have been constructed. All of this has created major problems for anyone traveling around the city. Bennett Gechner has more in this piece, first aired in June.
Before the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, getting around Baghdad was a breeze. But these days, it's an entirely different story. Mohammed Fadl is a government worker who lives in Baghdad. He has to deal with the problem of traffic every single day.
Commuting in Baghdad is awful. It's very difficult. There are many things that make it that way. One of them is the checkpoints on the roads to provide security for the people. Another problem is the heavily dense population and vehicles in the city. In addition to that, you have closed down roads, which create huge traffic jams.
When U.S. troops arrived in Baghdad, they were followed shortly thereafter by tens of thousands of imported cars. Baghdad's highways weren't ready for the flood of the new automobiles, nor was the government prepared for increased security threats, especially the Iraqi insurgents' weapon of choice, the car bomb. Sardar Polat, a Turkish man who works for a legal company, has been living in Iraq since 2005.
So it is a war place, yeah. Now everybody says it's a little bit safe, but I will not. I cannot believe that. It's not a safe place. Every day you can see lots of bombs. You can hear somebody killed, somebody kidnapped.
But like Fadl said, the government's response, security checkpoints, slows traffic down even more. Marwan Kazan is an Iraqi college student who lives in downtown Baghdad. He thinks that checkpoints might be more trouble than they're worth.
They search our car to see if there are bombs, or weapons, or suspicious men or wanted men, and they are just looking. They don't do any real checking. They don't do real things, or stop the terrorists' execution or arrest the terrorists, only make us late for our college or work. I see there is no benefit of these checkpoints. All Iraqi people see that.
About halfway through my conversation with Marwan, the power in his house unexpectedly went out. He seemed unfazed by the incident, so I wasn't surprised when he told me about something else that plagues Baghdad's drivers.
I don't see more signals, and if they exist, they don't work, or it is necessary to follow police officers to organize the cars. Since there is no electricity in Iraqi streets, the signals don't work. Except in some streets, there are signals working all the time, because it's an important street.
But let's say you do manage to avoid any possible attacks. You've gone through checkpoints and navigated through busy traffic without the aid of basic signals, and you're at your destination. Now what? Are you just going to sidle up to the curb, get out, and go about your business? Chances are, your car will attract the attention of the police and won't be there when you return. Here's Polat again.
You cannot stop your car
in many places. You have to go to the parking place. The parking place. They told the government that, but I don't believe it. Mafia, like parking mafia, you know?
You have to pay money to them, but not too much, $1 or $2, maybe. On the main road, you cannot park your car because the policemen or soldiers don't allow you to park there.
I asked about alternatives. Many Iraqis take taxis, but they're too expensive for everyday use. And, especially for foreigners living in Iraq, cost isn't always the biggest problem.
Normally, the taxi is dangerous. You don't know who they are, who the driver is, you know? There are no legal authorities in here. You don't know who he is. Maybe just a driver of a taxi. He can be a terrorist. He can kidnap you. You don't even know. And if you're foreign, they know you. They know that you come in from the other country.
You're coming from the other country.
There aren't very many buses in Baghdad anymore, but there is a fairly extensive network of microbuses, vans that can hold up to 11 people. They don't run late into the night due to security concerns, but they're cheaper than taxis and have other advantages too. Though Fadl, the government worker, owns a car, he actually prefers taking the microbus.
Most people don't use their personal cars and use other means to commute, because if you're on the road driving your car and a bomb goes off, you're stuck and you can't leave your car in the middle of the road. But if you're using a microbus, you can exit and walk out of the mess.
Even though this affects everyone in Baghdad, employers are often surprisingly indifferent. It takes Fadl over an hour to travel the 3 miles to his work.
At work, they're not concerned about how I get there. They want me to show up for work at 8 in the morning, even if I was stuck in a bombing or something else. So if I show up late, they'll cut from my salary. They'll cut about $20 for each day I'm late.
The whole situation turns even the simplest errands or visits into, at best, major headaches. Here's Kazan again.
To visit a near neighborhood or near friend, I can walk. It's simple. But if they are in a far street, I must drive. So I don't visit my friends much, because of the time I need to travel to them, just on the weekend.
The real problem with all of this is that there's no one working on a solution. Fadl says people's complaints fall on deaf ears.
Projects to widen streets and open new ones do not exist. There are only projects to close down roads and set up new checkpoints. Every official moves with a big motorcade, and the motorcade blocks the road 15 minutes before he leaves to protect his route, while ordinary Iraqis have to wait out in the sun and heat until roads are clear.
Fixing traffic isn't something that's on the top of anyone's list right now, and it won't be until there's greater security. But on the streets of Baghdad, that's not a very simple goal. More often than not, the presence of troops doesn't improve security on the roads. Polat is often worried about safety when traveling.
When you see lots of soldiers and policemen, it means some bad thing will happen. Maybe they'll take some information, some attack will come, or somebody will explode some bomb somewhere. It's not safe. Normally, when you see lots of soldiers, it shows more safety. No. In Baghdad, no.
But people in Baghdad aren't waiting around to continue their normal lives, even if it does mean sacrificing some safety.
After we finish our job, I like to visit parts of Baghdad. I tell my friend I want to go to a safe place, and we go to some restaurant for dinner or for lunch. But I can say, it's not too much safety. When you sit in Baghdad, you cannot feel you are safe.
For War News Radio, I'm Bennett Gechner.
This is War News Radio. IEDs, or improvised explosive devices, are tucked around every corner in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're buried under roads, hidden in tires and weeds, packed into cars, and even sewn into the clothing of suicide bombers. The U.S. military has poured money into programs designed to prevent, detect, and eliminate IEDs, but they still cause the majority of casualties for U.S. troops. Amadine Lee brings us more on the evolution of the IED and counter-IED technology in this piece, first aired in July.
everything will blow to pieces. Yeah. $400,000 down the drain. Yeah, we're probably going to have to back up for this one.
Yeah. Oh! That was an explosive ordnance disposal team using a robot to detonate an IED at a safe distance. This is now a daily occurrence in Iraq and Afghanistan because IEDs, which encompass car bombs, suicide bombs, and most commonly roadside bombs, have grown to be the ideal tactic for insurgent groups. John Grossman, engineer for the RAND Corporation, which works with the military on counter-IED efforts, explains.
It's become a weapon of choice amongst these people because, you know, what other weapon can you think of that, you know, you can be a coward hiding and set it off, or you can be a martyr and set it off, you know, when you're in front of other people.
This is why the Joint IED Defeat Organization, or JIDO, was created in 2006 to deal specifically with the threat of IEDs. Here's Command Sergeant Major Todd Burnett, who was commander of Joint Task Force Paladin in Iraq.
You know, we have three lines of operation that we operate, and that's train the force, defeat the device, and attack the network.
IEDs are improvised explosive devices, meaning that they are made of almost anything that will produce a bang, put together with whatever junk is on hand. But all IEDs have a few key components: an explosive charge, a switch to initiate the device, a power source such as a battery, a detonator to set off the charge, and finally, a container to hold it all together. The simplest IEDs are incredibly inexpensive and easy to create. Here's John Grossman again.
Right now, I mean, basically, you're talking about maybe $5 worth of electronics and batteries, and, you know, the explosives tend to be, you know, just sort of literally laying on the road. And that's been one of the problems, that they're cheap. You know, even the most sophisticated one, you know, you're only talking $10,000 total, and that would probably include the vehicle you want to put it in.
In Iraq, a lot of the materials for IEDs only became available after the U.S. invasion. Then, American troops failed to protect Saddam's munitions stockpiles, leaving vast quantities of artillery shells and mines loaded with explosives vulnerable to looters. In Afghanistan, some explosives also come from the remnants of war. However, the grand majority are manufactured from nitrogen-based fertilizers, very prevalent in a country dominated by farms. Colonel Bert Jess, senior military advisor for JIDO, explains.
I'd say at least 70%. The idea that they call homemade explosives. So if you take ammonia nitrate, which is pretty common, and you can make the explosive charge out of that, potassium chlorate. So the challenge in Afghanistan is that people use this stuff as fertilizers for their crops.
The most popular and most dangerous type of IED in Iraq is an EFP, or explosively formed projectile. Command Sergeant Major Burnett saw dozens of IED attacks during his tenure in Iraq.
It has a liner that's concaved. And it has a main charge behind it that's, if you will, kind of in a coffee can type of cylinder. And what it's meant to do is the main charge is behind it, and it pushes the projectile to the vehicle.
This bullet-like chunk of molten metal is incredibly powerful. Grossman elaborates.
The projectile, this is a molten metal that can go through most armor, you know, up into what's, you know, on a tank. And so they tend to be very deadly against Humvees, MRAPs. Other vehicles, usually they're triggered by the same motion detector that's on your burglar alarm, which means they're very difficult to deal with because if you don't know where the kill zone is for them, basically they're just looking for a vehicle basically that's sufficient, has enough thermal capacity that it, you know, as it goes by the IED, essentially you set a burglar alarm off.
The burglar alarm is only one of many ways in which IEDs are initiated. Jess talks again about other popular types of detonators.
There's three types of the three most prevalent types of IEDs in Afghanistan are victim operated. So it's a pressure plate or a tripwire. That's the most common IED. That's followed by a what we call a command wire IED, which you would have a wire running up to maybe 2 kilometers to either to activate it or just to pull a device. And it would be easier if I could show you the devices. But and then the third type is radio controlled IED, RCIED.
The military has spent over $17 billion on technology to counter IEDs. For example, as Grossman explains, troops carry around radio jammers to interfere with frequencies from cell phones, radios, and long-range cordless phones that insurgents use to send a signal to detonate bombs.
Yeah, you know, you can certainly make jammers, you can make you know, anything that basically requires an electronic pulse to turn it on. can always make a pulse that will turn it on either at the wrong time. It can be good or bad, depending on how good you are at selecting the right time.
Many buried IEDs in Afghanistan are triggered by pressure plates. They use the weight of the vehicle to complete an electric circuit, igniting the bomb. As the military started to devise tactics to detect and prevent buried bombs, the Taliban evolved to cope, as Colonel Jess describes.
All it is just establishing a contact. As like I said, when I first got there, it was saw blades touching metal, metal-metal contact. Then the enemy knows that we use metal detectors, and which is easy for us to find. So the more metal they use, the better off we are. So they try to reduce that signature. They call we called it low metal IEDs. And so they went to carbon rods from inside of a battery. So if you took a D battery cell right now, or a AAA battery, you cut it open, you see a carbon rod in the middle. Well, that contact right there causes a charge. So where they started using tinfoil from cigarette packets.
Even hard-to-detect low-metal IEDs, however, can be countered by using mine rollers. These are attachments at the front of military vehicles that set off the bomb before it goes under the treads. In fact, a lot of technology has focused on trying to help soldiers survive inevitable explosions. The military has developed a menagerie of vehicles, Cougar, Buffalo, Husky, and MRAP, with heavily armored exteriors and angles designed to divert blasts. And then there's robots and drones with detectors that identify newer asphalt where IEDs might be buried. Anything to remove the soldier from the bombs. They also focus heavily on training troops to identify possible IEDs, suicide bombers, and good locations for traps. Meanwhile, as insurgents trade recipes for bombs by word of mouth and online, EOD units continue to recover IEDs and bring them to labs to discover insights.
One lab we had was called the SEXE, C-E-X-E. Standing for Combined Explosive Exploitation Cell, which when we take one of these IEDs, like I said before, we're able to get biometrics. We're able to get fingerprints. Biometrics means fingerprints or DNA off the IEDs. We also are able to look at some of the technical components of it. Even though it's made out of wood and tinfoil and saw blades, there are some technical components of it, and we're able then to leverage all this national power.
In the meantime, however, IEDs have grown to account for almost 60% of casualties for American troops, and kill and maim even more civilians who lack military training and equipment. Here's Burnett again.
It's still the number one problem on the battlefield is still the IED. And how I relate that to people is the IED has become a condition of our workplace or our environment in theater. It's a problem that we're going to deal with, and we're going to deal with it for a long time to come.
For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. Iraqis often move to more secure areas to escape the threat of sectarian violence, and these areas are often home to some high-ranking government officials. In the United States, to live near anyone with the slightest degree of celebrity, even a congressman, is glamorous, but inconsequential. In Iraq, a high-profile neighbor can have a significant impact on your daily life. Karim Sari Ahmed and Bennett Gechner have the story in this piece, first aired in July.
With all the images on the news of dilapidated Iraqi streets, we wondered what it would be like to live in a VIP neighborhood.
We figured that there must be some perks to living next door to ministers, parliament members, or even clerics.
Someone with any considerable degree of power would be able to access reliable utilities and services, and have higher security than the average Iraqi.
Civilians in the area would also share this access. We talked to Isra, a woman living in a Baghdad neighborhood where many government officials also live.
Of course, you feel more secure. You feel VIP yourself.
You feel more secure. You feel like a VIP yourself. You feel more privileged than anyone in another neighborhood. Sometimes those important neighbors even get free electricity for us. They have big generators and they just give out free electricity for 24 hours and you really feel safer. It's a heavily guarded area. You don't need to bring your own guards or worry that your house will be robbed or broken into.
Average Iraqis have electricity in their homes for 1 out of every 5 or 6 hours.
So she's pretty lucky in this respect.
Yeah, but just having some public figure down the street doesn't always mean you're going to benefit. Mohammed Fadl is a good example of this. He lives near a Shiite cleric.
In the beginning, Sheikh Yassin helped out the neighborhood using his connections to provide services. But later on, he stopped helping out the neighborhood. After that, he was only concerned with his personal interests.
Isra says that living near government officials provides potentially useful connections.
And if you need a job, some recommendation, you just knock on their door. You could be more trusted by those officers, and sometimes they give you the chance to work for them. Because they know that you live here, they know your family, they know whether you're someone to be trusted with their secrets. Then they would favor you over other applicants for a job.
This, of course, depends on who specifically lives near you and their relationship with their neighbors.
Most of them, you like make friends with the
bodyguards. Because most of them, you make friends with the bodyguards because they're always on the street and they're always looking at you. They know you. So if you just talk to them, you can make a request to Mr. X or Y or Z. Sometimes they work on that, and they don't mind giving you a show of gratitude for bearing or enduring all the troubles that they cause you.
Those troubles may, in some cases, be worth something like electricity, which is still a privilege in Iraq.
But, as Isra says,
living in an upper-scale neighborhood, or one where your neighbors are high-profile officials, is like a double-edged sword, a double-edged weapon.
A lot of drama follows officials to their places of residence, and locals often pay the price.
But it's been problematic to live in this neighborhood because, again, there might be a massive bombing or you might have suicide rockets or mortars from other remote areas because they want to target the officials inside the neighborhood, and then the whole neighborhood will be at risk. Of course, you cannot lead a normal life.
All these problems were caused by this cleric, so he cut down the vital routes for the community so that he can protect himself. Now the neighborhood is all closed.
It's been like this for some time now. During election times, there were high-profile officials getting assassinated, and that's why they were much more careful about their security. So it has always been like this.
The cleric who lives near Mohammed caused a huge disruption when he moved in.
The cleric closed down the neighborhood in 2005, when sectarian violence was high. There was a highway that separated two neighborhoods, one Sunni and the other Shia. Both groups used to wage attacks from that highway, so people started avoiding the highway and instead took another route. The cleric moved into the neighborhood and lived at a house on that route. Then he closed down that road. He kicked out car mechanics that had set up shop across his house. He also set up checkpoints to protect his house.
Restrictions on travel have prevented Iraqis from seeing their families, even when they live down the street.
I go to my parents' house every other day, and I know what it's like to drive around the whole neighborhood just to get to their house. You really suffer to get to their house.
When I want to visit my relatives who live a few blocks away, who live very close to one of the houses of the one of the main parties here in Iraq, I get stopped by the checkpoint. My car would be searched, and then they would ask for my ID before letting me in. I have to call my relatives and ask my name or if they know me. I get different questions before they let me in. It really makes it impossible for me to visit my relatives regularly.
Getting in and out of the neighborhood is an even greater ordeal for Isra.
My recent experience was only yesterday,
when I was driving my car and I wanted to pick up my nephew from another neighborhood of Baghdad. And because it also coincided with the Shia march, on my voyage back home, we were stopped at one of the major points and were prevented from getting into the area. I use my own car and I drive myself around Baghdad, but also there are times when the whole area would be closed off. Whenever I want to come back, then I have to prove to them that, believe me, I live in that neighborhood. And sometimes they ask me to show them the documents that prove to them that I truly live here. Or sometimes, if some of those bodyguards recognize my car or recognize me, then they say, okay, let her in so she lives in that neighborhood.
She says she just has to use her own good judgment in traveling.
It depends on your own estimation.
Sometimes it depends on your own estimation. If you follow a lot of the news, you hear that, for example, this area has been attacked recently. Then no, I should not go there by myself. I should not drive my car. I should have someone with me escorting me to this area.
The sense of confinement is shared by everyone in the neighborhood.
So imagine what it's like to be a woman in this situation.
You know our social norms. I mean, a woman cannot
walk. You know our social norms. A woman cannot walk without a veil in front of strangers. And sometimes at your home, you want to have some time to relax and to be free of all the restrictions. I wear my veil during the day when I go to work. But when I'm at home, I really need to be free of all those restrictions. And if I want to just go and water the flowers or water my garden, it's hard for me to be unveiled because I know there'll be some men watching me.
Isra is put off by the lack of privacy, which restricts her in her daily life.
But overall, she feels relatively safe in her neighborhood.
That's more than most Iraqis can say for their homes. Residents of Mohammed's neighborhood feel genuinely threatened.
There were tensions when he closed down some of the businesses in the neighborhood. But those tensions soon ended, because people are afraid of him. They know that he is backed by higher powers, so people tend to avoid trouble.
For War News Radio, I'm Karim Sari Ahmed.
And I'm Bennett Gekner.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Karim Sari Ahmed. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Kyle Crawford.
And I'm Kate Aronoff. Until next time, thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.